Today I'm talking on surveillance state, the colonial pacification of the Philippines, and the rise of the U.S. internal security apparatus. Let me begin with a prologue to introduce the topic. At what might be midpoint in an American century of global dominion, from 1950 to, say, 2050, it seems about time to inquire into the character of history's most powerful empire, to ask at long last, what kind of empire is this American imperium? American historians have spent so many decades in denial about the reality of this U.S. empire that we still understand surprising little about its conduct, its character, or its consequences for American democracy. To fill this void, this vast void between the enormity of America's empire and the paucity of our knowledge about it, 6 years ago, a loose working group of over 100 scholars from four continents has convened a series of seminars in Madison, Manila, Sydney, and this June upcoming, Barcelona. The fruits of these academic labors are found in two books published last year, an edited volume titled Colonial Crucible, Empire in the Making of the Modern American State, and my own monograph, the one that Laurie mentioned, Policing America's Empire, released just last October. In pursuit of this problem, the nature of the American empire, our Empires Project asked two questions that most American historians have long failed to ask or answer. First, what is the essential character of this American imperium? That is, how does it manage its administration, pacification, and most importantly, I would argue, information? Second, what impact has this exercise of power abroad had upon the formation of the modern American state and the quality of its democracy? To explore these challenging questions, let me begin with a very simple anecdote. In July 1971, the New York Times published a curious story buried inside on page 5 about, quote, a private dossier on alleged communists kept for 23 years by a retired Army colonel and his wife, end quote. Just recently, this story in the New York Times continued, the Pentagon had sent this dossier to the U.S. Senate's Internal Security Subcommittee, then famed for its witch hunting pursuit of American communists. Before shipping these papers off to the U.S. Senate, the Army had investigated, finding this wasn't just a dossier, but was in fact a massive private archive full of secret, classified reports from the Army, Navy, and FBI on some 250,000 suspected subversives, all compiled by a long-forgotten Army general, Ralph Van Diemen, who had died almost 20 years earlier in 1952. This military investigator remarked, quote, the extent, detail, and quality of the information obtained by Van Diemen is remarkable. Indeed, in this era of anti-Vietnam protest, when concern over civil liberties was strong, the New York Times followed up this story with an editorial that damned these files as a repository of, quote, anti-labor, anti-Semitic, and anti-civil rights bias, and demanded that they be destroyed. But the general's ghost could not be exercised by simply burning a few bundles of paper. For General Van Diemen's influence was in fact embedded deep inside the institutional architecture of the U.S. internal security apparatus that he was so instrumental in building during World War I. Amidst the frenzy of mobilization for this great war, police methods that had been tested and perfected in the colonial Philippines migrated homeward, providing precedents and personnel for the establishment of a U.S. internal security apparatus that would persist for the next half century after World War I as a defining feature of American political life. In this process of imperial mimesis, a state like the United States that creates a colony with circumscribed civil liberties and pervasive policing soon begins to exhibit many of those same coercive features back home inside its own society. This colonial security apparatus had its origins in what I call America's first information revolution. During one extraordinary decade, the 1870s to the 1880s, America's first information revolution arose from a synergy of innovations in the management of textual, statistical, and visual data that created for the first time the technical capacity for surveillance of the many rather than just a few, a defining attribute, I would argue, of a modern state. Let's listen as the dates sing to us a cappella, a song of progress. Within these few years, the sum of Thomas Edison's quadruplex telegraph, 1874, Philo Remington's commercial typewriter, 1874, and Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, 1876, allowed the transmission and recording of textual data in unprecedented quantities at unequaled speed with unsurpassed accuracy. This dynamic decade also saw parallel progress in the management of statistical and visual data. After the engineer Hermann Hollerith patented the punch card in 1889, and the U.S. Census Bureau adopted the system in 1890 to enumerate 62 million Americans in just a few weeks, the nation was stunned. With Hollerith's electrical tabulating machine, clerks could process up to 20,000 cards per day, a success that later led Hollerith to become one of the founders of the International Business Machines Corporation, better known by its acronym IBM. Almost simultaneously, the development of photo engraving, 1881, and George Eastman's roll film, 1889, extended this information revolution to visual data. With a surprising simultaneity, parallel innovations in data storage allowed the reliable encoding and rapid retrieval from this rising tide of information. At opposite ends of the same small state in the 1870s, Melville Dewey, as in Dewey Decimal System, began cataloging the Amherst College Library. And Charles A. Cutter developed a similar system at Boston's Athenaeum Library that became the basis for the Library of Congress catalog, now the world standard. Within a decade, U.S. libraries, hospitals, and armed forces applied their discovery of the smart number to create systems that reduce otherwise unmanageable masses of data to numerical codes for rapid filing, retrieval, and cross-referencing, allowing a rapid modernization of the federal bureaucracy. In quick succession, for example, the Office of Naval Intelligence created a card method for recording intelligence in 1882, and the U.S. Army's Military Information Division adopted the same system 3 years later, 1885. Indicative of the torrid tempo of this information revolution, the MID, the Military Intelligence Division, intelligence cards grew from 4,000 cards in 1892 to over 300,000 cards a decade later. Now, American police circa 1900 were little more than cesspits of corruption and incompetence ruled by big city bosses. Thus, this information revolution came to crime detection from both foreign and domestic sources. At Paris police headquarters in 1882, about this same time, Alphonse Bertillon discovered modern biometrics by creating a criminal identification system with 11 cranial and corporeal measurements and two facial photographs, front view and side view, that was adopted within a decade as the American standard for criminal identification. During the 1890s, however, the Inspector General of Police for India, Sir Edward Henry, adopted the Bengali legal practice of thumbprinting. The Bengalis, for over a century, whenever they had a document in court, they would take their thumb, put on a pad, and boom, bunk, and a British colonial official started noticing, what do they do that for? You know, it looks a little different. They're not the same. You know? Gee, maybe there's a pattern here. Anyway, so Henry codified the thumbprint, and he created the modern system, the Henry system of fingerprint classification. He brought the system home to Scotland Yard in 1901, and then to America in 1904, when a British police sergeant demonstrated this new biometric at the St. Louis World's Fair for the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which, like the World Series is in the World Series, the International Association of Chiefs of Police is actually just the American Association. But anyway, all the American police chiefs saw it, and it very quickly spread across the United States. This coincidental fusing of these two innovations, Henry's fingerprint classification and Bertillon's biometrics, created the modern system of criminal identification found today. For example, when you walk into a post office and you see that poster, okay, right, it's always squarish. Why is it squarish? Because that's the same size and shape of Bertillon's original card that he began developing in Paris police headquarters in 1882. Okay, and the photograph is always front view and side view, just like Bertillon had in his first cards. While an imitator in criminal identification, America was an international innovator in the field of police and fire communications, with the Gamewell Corporation adapting telegraphy and telephony to create centralized alarm systems that became the world standard. By 1900, America's cities were wired with 764 municipal fire alarm systems and 148 police patrol networks, handling a total of 41 million messages in a single year. But On the eve of empire in 1898, Congress, courts, and civil society still barred any federal application of these innovations, leaving the U.S. government with near zero capacity, and I do mean zero capacity, for law enforcement or investigation beyond the customs barrier. In 1900, the United States was still what the historian Stephen Skowronek has called a patchwork state, that is, a weak state, leaving ample room for modernization that came with stunning speed in the imperial decades that soon followed. After 1898, the conquest of the Philippines made the United States for the first time an imperial power, unleashing the potential of its new information technology. Instead of the Spanish state's iron garrote that crushed vertebrae in an exemplary public execution, the American regime pacified its new colony through a synergy of its new information technologies: telegraph, telephone, typewriter, photograph, and numbered file. This application of information to pacification was but one manifestation of a distinctively American approach to colonial rule. If European imperialists prized deep cultural knowledge of their colonial subjects, American imperialists preferred information, voluminous, accessible, and utilitarian. With their schoolboy studies of Latin and Greek, European colonials emerged from Oxford or Leiden with a classical approach to imperial rule, heading east beyond Suez to master Asian languages and probe their past for a timeless cultural essence. With their technical and vocational education, by contrast, American colonials adapted their new information technology for colonial rule, heading west across the Pacific for hasty, inherently superficial surveys of the Philippine present through census, mapping, meteorology, photography, taxonomy, and intelligence. If the prime aim of the modern state is, as James Scott argues, to establish metrics for rendering complex societies in, quote, a legible and administratively more convenient format, then U.S. imperial rule was unrivaled in its ability to read alien terrains through such surface reconnaissance. European scholars of empire, such as Niall Ferguson, who fault American imperialists for their aversion to foreign languages and cultural knowledge, failed to grasp what I would call the guiding genius of a distinctive U.S. imperial style grounded in short-term service and serviceable information. Yet such shallowness, such superficiality, should not be mistaken for a want of seriousness. For embedded within this seemingly surface engagement was a relentless drive for omniscience, even omnipotence, imbued with the capacity of challenge for a lethal response unchecked by any of the empathy that might have come from a deeper cultural understanding. Now, by history and circumstance, the U.S. Army that landed at Manila Bay in 1898 proved a surprisingly apt agency of colonial transformation. Apart from its efficient combat forces, the U.S. Army also carried the germ of this new information technology that would, within the first 3 years of military government, shape the subsequent character of the U.S. colonial state. In an expanding empire of western plains and tropical islands, only the Philippines challenged the coercive capacities of the U.S. Army with an extraordinary array of resistance: regular national army, guerrilla underground, messianic peasants, militant nationalists, Muslim separatists, and radical labor unions. In retrospect, the U.S. Army was trying to do something enormously ambitious: to defeat Asia's first national revolution by reversing step by step two full generations of political mobilization. First, defeat its army, and then subvert the ideas that were its inspiration. To contain this decade of revolution against its rule, the United States created a three-tier colonial security apparatus: the U.S. Army's Division of Military Information, the Manila Metropolitan Police, and the Philippines Constabulary. Let's take a very brief look at each of these three secret services, focusing on its innovations in the craft of intelligence and counterintelligence. First, the Division of Military Information. As it struggled to uproot guerrillas immersed in a rugged terrain and hostile populations, the U.S. Army slowly discovered the imperative of accurate information and established the Division of Military Information, significantly the first field intelligence unit in the 100-year history of the U.S. Army. In early 1901, Captain Ralph Dendiman, whom we met at the outset in that New York Times article and who was later known as the father of U.S. military intelligence — if you go to the U.S. Intelligence Command at Fort Huachuca and you type in his name, you will get to the museum, the Intelligence Museum, and they will tell you the father of their craft is General Van Diemen. In 1901, Captain Van Diemen assumed command of this still embryonic intelligence unit. Juxtaposing Van Diemen's very mediocre record as a military surgeon prior to this posting and his extraordinary achievements afterwards, it seems that Imperial warfare proved transformative for both this officer and his army. While the heroes of this Imperial age won public acclaim by exploring far-off Arctic and tropical frontiers, Van Diemen was quietly discovering an invisible interstice, a covert netherworld, just beneath society's surface, and he would devote the rest of his life to probing this shadowy realm. With a voracious appetite for raw data, Van Diemen's division launched in March 1901 a confidential project to literally map the entire guerrilla infrastructure by compiling data cards on every single influential Filipino, each card detailing physical appearance, personal finances, landed property, political loyalties, and kinship networks. Next, the Manila Metropolitan Police. During its three-year pacification of Manila from 1898 to 1901, because Manila was a site of urban guerrilla warfare and urban political mobilization by the Revolutionary Underground, the U.S. Army created a Metropolitan Police Force that applied military intelligence and data management to domestic espionage. At the start of formal colonial rule in 1901, Manila's Metropolitan Police added the most advanced of U.S. crime control technologies, a centralized phone network, the Gamewell system of police fire alarms, incandescent electrical streetlights, Bertillon's photo identification, and finally, fingerprinting. Within just 20 years, Manila's detectives would amass photographic files on 200,000 Manila residents, equivalent to 70% of the city's total population. That's 70% of the city's total population. Finally, the Philippines Constabulary. Only weeks after his inauguration, July 1901, the first U.S. Governor General, William Howard Taft, established the Philippines Constabulary as a long-arm, mobile police of 5,000 men with the dual mission of counterinsurgency and colonial intelligence. By fusing paramilitary policing and draconian sedition laws, Governor Taft created the prototype of the modern surveillance state that ruled through a total control over information, supple in its omniscience, suffocating in its omnipresence. Within this sprawling state security apparatus, it was the Constabulary's Information Division, its intelligence arm, that was charged with the most difficult mission of all, surveilling and subverting the ideals and ideologues who represented the ultimate challenge to U.S. colonial rule. Through penetration and surveillance by hundreds of Filipino spies, the Constabulary's Information Division probes private social space for incriminating information on both Filipino politicians and American colonials. Since Americans philandered, Filipinos gambled, and everybody embezzled, all Manila faced the constant threat of political death by scandal. Under U.S. colonial rule, every major political player, Filipino and American, had a private safe full of purloined and incriminating documents, ready for deployment for attack or defense in a relentless round of political scandal. The press, of course, is the visible face of scandal through its role in revelation. But as George Orwell reminds us in his novel Burmese Days, based on his 5 years of service with British Imperial Police in Burma in the 1920s, colonialism also fostered a political contestation over scandal mediated by police agents and native spies. Within this police panopticon in the Philippines, the Constabulary's Information Division was systematic in its collection of incriminating information and very selective in the release. Let's look quickly at two examples among hundreds, of information control. First, releasing scurrilous information to destroy an enemy, and second, suppressing scandal to protect an ally. First, an example of release. By 1904, Archbishop Gregory Aglipay was about to legitimate his nationalist schism, the Philippine Independent Church, which then controlled about 30% of Roman Catholic parishes, with a final critical step, the grant of apostolic succession from the U.S. Episcopal Church that would infuse Aglipay and his priests with the sacral power to turn bread and water into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. Now, at the time of his consecration as Obispo Maximo of the Philippine Independent Church, in Tondo, the poor quarter of Manila, Aglipay had kneeled down on the pavement and 15 Filipino priests had put their hands on him to infuse him with apostolic succession, to give him that sacral power, that magic. And even as they did it, I would argue that every one of them knew, in the hearts of hearts, because they were Catholic priests who had broken, they all knew that they couldn't do it, that they were not the lineal descendants of the laying hands from St. Peter, the first bishop of Rome, that their act, their public act, was essentially a fraud. In the colonial Manila, Agripa's most likely source of this sacral touch was the Episcopal Church. But Constabulary Chief Henry Allen, the founder of the Constabulary, blocked this critical final step by mailing the Episcopal bishops at their Boston Convention in 1904 an intelligence profile of Aglipay stating that during the Revolution, Archbishop Aglipay had prowled Catholic nunneries for sexual prey, the nuns and their young charges, and, this was the sensational allegation, had during the Revolution ordered the Spanish bishop of Ilocos flogged with 300 lashes. Now, what's wrong with this story about 300 lashes? What's wrong with the story? Yeah, and the bishop didn't die, okay? For example, in ancient Rome, okay, a death penalty was 40 lashes. That's why most theologians figure that Christ, when Pilate ordered Christ to be whipped, he only got 39. Because it wasn't a death penalty. Okay, so 300 lashes is, you know, at least a triple death penalty. You know, and the bishop didn't die, so it was a transparent fraud. By penetrating this sanctum of sacral mystery, the Constabulary had, for the price of a postage stamp, delivered a major blow to this new Philippine church, one of several colonial moves that soon sent it into a rapid decline. More broadly, this anecdote indicates that the Constabulary had, within the space of just 3 years of his establishment, not only discovered the importance of information, but it had, with surprising speed, mastered the craft of disinformation. Next, an example of the suppression of information to protect an ally. Among the thousands, nay, the tens of thousands of intelligence reports that crossed his desk, the chief of constabulary, the founder of the Philippine Constabulary, General Henry T. Allen, carried just one report from Manila, through command of a division in World War I, through his command of the German Rhineland after the war, and into retirement near Washington, D.C., where he was very briefly considered as the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. What was this report? Compiled by the Division of Military Information, this report was titled The Family History of MQ. This report alleged that Manuel Quezon, a prominent Philippine politician after whom the nation's capital, Quezon City, is now named, had concealed a premarital liaison with his half-sister and future first lady by arranging an abortion. Among its many sordid tales, and they are many, of murder and sex, this report also alleged that Quezon had also buried the fruit of a similar liaison with her sister, his other half-sister, in Manila's Pacos Cemetery. This knowledge of intimate details, the most intimate details imaginable, inside a private household, indicates the colonial police's capacity to penetrate even the most private of social space. But since Quezon cooperated fully with the constabulary, serving as a spy and agent throughout his career, this document remains safely buried in General Allen's private files until Allen's death, assisting Quezon's unchecked rise to the Philippine presidency in 1935. The creation of this colonial police panopticon would prove mutually transformative, making the constabulary and its success of the Philippine National Police an arm of Philippine presidential power throughout the 20th century and leaving a lasting institutional imprint on the U.S. state. Let's now shift from the Philippines to the United States and see how these innovations at the imperial periphery came home to America. As the U.S. Army plunged into the conquest of the Philippines in 1899, a group of northern intellectuals known as the anti-imperialists decried the impact of empire upon American democracy. The eminent and very conservative Yale sociologist William Graham Sumner warned that, quote, the inevitable effect of imperialism on democracy will necessitate stronger and more elaborate governmental machinery with a militarism that will slowly yet surely diminish America's constitutional freedoms. Similarly, in an imagined history of 20th century America written far off at some fictional point in the future, Mark Twain wrote that, quote, the lust for conquest had long ago destroyed the great American Republic because trampling upon the helpless abroad had taught her by a natural process to endure with apathy the like at home. But the impact of empire was both less direct and more profound than these critics could have imagined. Indeed, 20 years after their dire predictions, during World War I, these colonial police methods migrated homeward through the invisible capillaries of empire to provide blueprints for two new U.S. Army commands, military intelligence and military police, that were the foundation for a new U.S. internal security apparatus. Now, when the United States entered World War I in April 1917, the U.S. Army, after abolishing its intelligence division, its fledgling intelligence division 10 years before, was the only army on either side of the battle lines in Europe that didn't have intelligence service. This is extraordinary. The German army had for a century made intelligence one of the four basic components of its general staff. So here we were fighting a modern war, a brutal modern war without an intelligence service. Within weeks of America's entry into the war, the U.S. Secretary of War designated Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, whom we last met in Manila fighting Philippine revolutionaries, to establish U.S. military intelligence. Van Diemen quickly recruited a staff that grew from just one employee himself to 1,700 and quickly devised the entire institutional architecture for America's first internal security agency. Just as the Philippine Constabulary had used Filipino undercover operatives necessarily to penetrate Philippine society, so Colonel Van Diemen designated U.S. internal security as a unique fusion of federal agencies and civilian auxiliaries, giving this apparatus the mass force of a social movement and the institutional continuity of a state bureaucracy, attributes that explains its persistence, pervasiveness, and power for the next 50 years. In collaboration with the FBI, Colonel Van Diemen presided over a civilian counterintelligence auxiliary, the American Protective League, with 300,000 citizen operatives who amassed over 1 million pages of type surveillance report on German Americans in just 14 months. Arguably the world's most extensive domestic surveillance to date. So extensive was this surveillance that when I was doing research, I was stunned in the U.S. National Archives to open a file and find my grandfather's letters to my great-grandmother in the records of the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Division. What was my grandfather? A subversive, a spy, a triple agent? No. He was a lab technician in an Army hospital in North Carolina, but he was German-American, so his letters are in the file. Otherwise, actually, thank goodness, otherwise they would have been lost. But anyway, there it was. I was stunned. Not only did my grandfather have a number, his brother had a number, the family was penetrated, spies, agents, it goes on and on. I mean, it's amazing. A cousin was a top U.S. intelligence operative in Switzerland, penetrated the family. It just honeycombed the society in a way you can't even begin to imagine. Just like Manila. Similarly, General Harry Bandholtz drew upon his 7 years in command of the Philippine Constabulary to establish the U.S. Army's military police in 1918, and at war's end deployed 32,000 of these American MPs in 400 cities and towns across Western Europe. Today, if you happen through Budapest, Hungary, you will find an heroic bronze statue of General Bandholtz in a public park near the U.S. Embassy commemorating his police service in a war-torn Europe. After armistice in 1918, military intelligence organized the American Legion to counter the socialist left during the so-called Red Scare, a period marked by mob action across the Midwest, the notorious Luster raids in New York City, J. Edgar Hoover's Palmer raids in cities across the Northeast, and military operations across the United States, particularly here in Seattle. Yet so blatant were these excesses that in the military demobilization of the early 1920s, there was a sharp cutback in internal security operations by both the Army and the FBI. Now, if General Van Diemen's wartime service won him the title as the father of U.S. military intelligence, then his activities after his retirement from the Army should earn him another title as the father of the American blacklist. From his retirement in 1929 until his death in 1952, General Van Diemen and his wife worked tirelessly from their comfortable bungalow in San Diego, building that private counterintelligence archive and compiling cards on 250,000 suspected subversives. Although the Depression decade of the 1930s brought a surge of radicalism by both left and right, U.S. internal security could not expand after its cutbacks during the 1920s. creating a void that Van Diemen filled by coordinating an elaborate exchange of information among military intelligence, police red squads, and citizen vigilante groups. On the eve of World War II, the U.S. military intelligence revived from its deep interwar doldrums to play a central role in the mass relocation of Japanese Americans. Within weeks of the Pearl Harbor attack, Army intelligence in Washington, D.C. did a detailed demographic study of Japanese settlement in California, concluding first that they were settled in clusters near California's strategic war industries, and second, that conventional surveillance could not succeed in containing this serious threat. Simultaneously, Van Diemen's apparatus in California began generating intelligence that Japanese imperial espionage was embedded deep inside the Japanese-American community in ways that made this potential threat seem like a present danger, providing some of the pretext for the mass incarceration of over 100,000 Japanese Americans. By 1944, with his counterintelligence mission accomplished and the nation secure, Van Diemen returned to his core work of breaking the Communist Party's penetration of Hollywood. By the late 1930s, Van Diemen's swelling archive of, by that time, 40,000 file cards on suspected subversives was focused above all on Hollywood, an emphasis evident in the card in his archive for Ring Lardner Jr., an Oscar-winning writer for MGM Studios, later blacklisted. This card read, quote, "Subject reported by good authority to be a rabid communist and is reported to be recruiting members for the Young Communist League in Los Angeles." It goes on with other details. Indicating the general spreading network, the source for this report, as noted on the card, was Commandant, 3rd Naval District, New York. In the aftermath of World War II, the nation's public-private security apparatus again expanded to create the mass anti-communist movement identified with Senator Joseph McCarthy. In this anti-communist crusade, Van Diemen worked closely with the FBI and with the California Committee on American Activities, planning every detail of the state legislature's public expose of the Communist Party, particularly in Hollywood. In June 1949, this California committee, headed by State Senator Jack Tenney, best known as the author of that classic, unforgettable pop song, Mexicali Rose. Anybody here know Mexicali Rose? That's Jack Tenney. Anyway, moving right along. Your education. Not a younger generation. Just don't know the classics. So let's go on. Tenney drew upon General Van Diemen's archive to issue a sensational 709-page report denouncing hundreds of Hollywood luminaries as red appeasers, including Charlie Chaplin, Maurice Chevalier, Katharine Hepburn, Danny Kaye, Ring Lardner Jr., Maurice Chevalier, I said him already, Gregory Peck, Edward G. Robinson, Artie Shaw, Orson Welles, and note this one, Senator Helen Gahagan Douglas. And wait for it, you won't believe it, Hoboken's favorite son, old Mr. Blue Eyes himself, yes, Frank Sinatra, communist. Exemplifying the distinct public-private alliance that marked U.S. internal security, General Van Diemen's private archive served as a conduit for moving security reports, classified security reports, from closed government files into the hands of citizen anti-communist groups for blacklisting and public denunciation. For example, in the 1946 congressional elections in California, an obscure Los Angeles lawyer named Richard Nixon, who had never before held elective office, reportedly used Van Diemen's files to circulate pink sheets at rallies denouncing the incumbent, very popular Democratic Congressman Jerry Voorhees as a communist. And these pink sheets were critical to Nixon's, surprising upset victory over Congressman Voorhees. 4 years later, Representative Richard Nixon reportedly used the same files and the same tactics to defeat the actress and U.S. Senator Helen Gahagan Douglas, launching Richard Nixon on a path to the presidency of the United States. This archive did not die with its creator. Just 61 minutes after General Van Diemen passed away at his San Diego home in January 1952, a telex with the news of his death hit the desk of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover 3,000 miles away in Washington, D.C. Within hours, a team from the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps occupied the Van Diemen home and spent the next 9 days securing and sorting his voluminous files before shipping them north to the Presidio in San Francisco. For the next 25 years, Van Diemen's massive files were used by the Army and then, in 1971, as I mentioned at the outset, were delivered to the U.S. Senate Internal Security Committee for investigation of suspected communists. Even after the anti-communist passions faded in the mid-1950s, the FBI continued its counterintelligence for the next 20 years under its COINTELPRO program, harassing both Black Civil Rights Campaign and the Vietnam Peace Movement with 2,370 illegal operations involving wiretaps, disinformation, and agent provocateur violence. After 50 years of unchecked federal surveillance, the political ferment of the 1970s finally brought reforms that imposed some legal restraint on these internal security operations. After a New York Times expose, Congress and the executive investigated to discover illegal domestic surveillance by the CIA's Operation Chaos and the FBI's COINTELPRO, forcing both the agency and the Bureau to rescind these domestic operations. But General Van Diemen's legacy lay too deep within the architecture of the U.S. internal security apparatus and too vivid in the collected memory of Republican conservatives for any such easy corrective. Let's now turn to our own time, the war on terror, and see if the same process of empire transforming domestic society is operating today. Revived after September 11, 2001, these illegal methods of mass surveillance, albeit in an electronic form, persist to the present with the potential to fuse both foreign and domestic innovations into a digital surveillance state. First, at home. At home here in the United States, there has been a major expansion of domestic surveillance by the FBI and the National Security Agency that has swept up several billion private documents. Since 2004, the FBI's so-called investigative data warehouse has acquired over a billion documents, including intelligence reports, Social Security files, driver's licenses, and private financial information, now accessible to 13,000 analysts making over a million inquiries monthly. Since 2005, moreover, the NSA, the National Security Agency's top secret database called Pinwheel, has allowed analysts to routinely scan millions of domestic electronic communications. Abroad, the Pentagon has applied biometric identification and electronic surveillance to pacify Iraq and Afghanistan, creating advances in surveillance that are now migrating homeward. This new biometric identification first appeared in the smoking aftermath of Operation Phantom Fury, that brutal 9-day battle that the U.S. Marines fought in late 2004 to recapture Fallujah, Iraq. After destroying half the city and sending most of its 250,000 inhabitants fleeing into the countryside, U.S. Marines then forced returning residents to wait at checkpoints under a desert sun for fingerprints and iris scans. Inside Baghdad, the U.S. Army confined the city's 7 million population behind blast wall cordons and then monitored their movements by collecting, as of early 2008, over a million Iraqi fingerprints and retinal scans accessible via satellite from a biometric database in West Virginia. In recent months, the U.S. Army has built a similar biometric database in Afghanistan. In the first months of President Obama's administration, CIA Predator drone strikes have used a top-secret mix of electronic intercepts, satellite transmission, and digital imaging to kill half of the agency's top-priority al-Qaeda targets inside Pakistan's tribal borderlands. In 2008, the Pentagon announced that one of its Iraq combat units would be reassigned inside the United States as a Consequence Management Response Force, or CMRF. In September 2008, the Army's Chief of Staff, General George Casey, staged the first full CMRF exercise at Fort Stewart, Georgia, to war game future military coordination with the FBI, FEMA, and local police for what they called civil unrest and crowd control. Disturbed by these developments, the American Civil Liberties Union petitioned the courts for the details of this deployment, arguing, quote, "It is imperative that the American people know the truth about this new, unprecedented intrusion of the military into domestic affairs," end quote. While President Obama has curtailed the CIA's foreign counterterror operations, he has expanded this internal security apparatus. In February 2009, Homeland Security launched its first Predator breed drones to patrol the vast North Dakota-Manitoba sector of the Canadian border that one U.S. senator has called America's weakest link. Moreover, Obama has created a new military cyber command staffed by 7,000 Air Force employees at Lackland Air Base, whose operations will necessarily intrude into domestic cyberspace. Let's close by speculating about the dystopian or anti-utopian potential of this new surveillance technology created by the war on terror. In the century since Sir Edward Henry first codified those Bengali or Indian fingerprints, the iris scan now represents the technological key to any future surveillance state. In the decades since a Cambridge University researcher developed the algorithms for infallible iris recognition, this camera computer identification system has been adopted by airports and immigration authorities worldwide. While it takes 2 or 3 days for a confirmed fingerprint match from the FBI's central database of 65 million fingerprints, a computerized iris confirmation now takes 15 seconds. If we draw together some still fragmentary evidence from around the globe, we can see something of the shape of this future digital surveillance state. Today in the United Kingdom, for example, there are an estimated 4 million security cameras sweeping the streets in a nation of just 60 million people. 4 million cameras, 60 million people. The million frequent travelers who are registered in the United Kingdom's iris recognition immigration system, whose code name is iris, simply glance into a camera while passing silently through automated checkpoints at airports nationwide in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, at a secret location in London, the National Public Order Intelligence Unit reads right across the databases of all internal security agencies to gather, assess, analyze, and disseminate intelligence information where there is a threat to public order which arises from domestic extremism. Just as Philippine colonial methods percolated homeward during World War I, so in the aftermath of some future terrorist attack on America, iris scans or facial recognition software could be married to the NSA's sweeps of domestic communications to create a digital surveillance state. If that day comes, America's cities will become argus-eyed in a relentless search for subversion, with police cameras scanning faces in all public space, the FBI monitoring fiber optic cables beneath the streets, and the NSA sweeping Wi-Fi wavelengths in the skies above. Comparing the relative impact of wars past and present on civil liberties and civil society in America and the wider world, the potential reach of today's digital surveillance, I would argue, is greater. Now, while the old shoe leather sleuthing and mail intercepts could only skim the very surface of private life during World War I, the recent migration of almost all personal, financial, and political communications into electronic media creates the potential for a much deeper digital surveillance of private lives today. And in contrast to the slow, informal exchange of biometric methods among imperial powers a century ago, today global counterterror operations assure a rapid proliferation of digital surveillance technologies from New York to Madrid, Mumbai, and Manila, and back again. Sadly, it appears that Mark Twain was right when he warned just over 100 years ago in his dour, misanthropic manner that America could not have both empire abroad and democracy at home. Such, it seems, are the costs of empire. Thank you. One of the things that I mentioned, that's agent provocateur. Okay, right. That's a classic thing. That's the ultimate counterintelligence operation. Okay, I mean, if you think about, you're moving from passivity, which is monitoring, reading the newspaper. Okay, having agents maybe at a public rally. That's very passive. Okay, then you go to penetration. You send agents in to a newspaper office or an organization, a labor union. Okay, or you turn the leadership of those organizations into your agents. Right, that's the next level. The ultimate level is agent provocateur. You send people in, or you turn somebody in the organization, and you provoke them to violence, and that discredits the organization and allows a crackdown. And since you know the violence is going to occur, and you have an agent who tells you exactly who's implicated, you've got them. The FBI is believed to have done that under COINTELPRO. They use agent provocateur tactics. And hometown, Madison, Wisconsin. Lori, where is Leo Burt? You know, remember the Sterling Hall bombing? Okay, there were four bombers. Okay, you want to find Carlton Armstrong? Okay, well, he used to be at the Radical Rye, but now he's at the, was it the Loose Juice, you know, on the mall right in front of the library, and, you know, Carlton's brother, and then this guy named Fine. But there was a fourth guy. Fourth guy, okay, the Sterling Hall bombing, you probably know this. These four guys, it's just like the Oklahoma bombing, but they did it in 1970, you know, way before Oklahoma City. They loaded up a truck with ammonia phosphate fertilizer, they mixed in oil, they got the combination just right, they drove between two buildings, Sterling Hall, 4 o'clock in the morning, they called, tell everybody to leave. There was a physics PhD student working late at night, married kid, boom, blew up the building, I mean, smashed the building. I mean, it just shattered glass for a mile around. It was an amazing explosion. Killed that man. they all four disappeared. Three of them were caught. Leo Burt, gone. Now, who's Leo Burt? He went to a high school. In his high school graduating class, there were five FBI agents. All right? He went to a conservative Catholic high school. He was on the varsity crew. Immediately, the wire services started carrying a story about how he was cut from the varsity crew, and he became very bitter by this experience, and that drove him to radicalism. Okay, now, one of the things I did for, you know, endless years in high school and college was I rode. And, you know, you always get cut. I mean, this is the most self-effacing sport, the whole ethos of the sport. The coach is just trying to balance the boat. It's not personal. You're just trying to get the pull right, okay? Okay, so you're always getting cut. You're always getting yanked out of the first boat and dropped in the second, or something. It's just part of the deal, okay? It's a very self-effacing sport. You know, this is not, you know, like tennis or something. That's nonsense. Complete, transparent disinformation. So I think Leo Burt, okay? I suspect Leo Burt. Go Google Leo Burt, you know? Okay? I suspect he's one of them, but we know the FBI did that, okay? Now, we don't know. We know that, for example, that one of the things that Hoover did was he collected incriminating information on U.S. Congress, on Martin Luther King's sexual derelictions, that sort of thing, and used it. And there's a famous meeting between Hoover and Martin Luther King in which Hoover is supposed to have confronted King with the tapes he had of his assignations, that sort of thing. But that was passive. In other words, you get the scurrilous information and you use it. That actually emerges, you know, at the highest levels in the Philippines. Right? For example, at the level of U.S. politics, Leonard Wood, very famous American imperialist, he was Governor General of Cuba. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor for his role in the capture of the famous Apache chief Geronimo, and he was Governor General of the Philippine Islands. Leonard Wood hated Jack Pershing, commander of U.S. forces. Pershing refused to allow Wood to command troops in World War I. And so when Wood came back to the Philippines, one of the things he did was he collected a photograph of Pershing's illegitimate half-Filipino child and he amassed, you know, that kind of documentation on Pershing. In other words, they collected that kind of stuff for use against each other. And for Americans who very often, American colonials who were usually single males, or sometimes were males detached from family, human beings being what they are, there were relationships, and those were all regarded as illicit. If you live with somebody, it was actually a crime, concubinage. So that they had that information on everybody. So, you know, the collection of that kind of incriminating information is, you know, is part of the way this apparatus operates. Yes?
For the Philippines, right after World War II, toward the end of World War II and after, was it, you know, set up as a part of the American Empire? And then how much were, like, Vandeveer's information and his methods used around that time, 1945?
At that point, one of the aspects of decolonization was that this apparatus was turned entirely over to the Philippine state. The constabulary and the information division, intelligence, became very much a part of the Philippine state. So this came into play in the history of U.S. foreign policy during the 1950s when CIA began working with the Philippine Armed Forces to pacify a major communist peasant uprising, the Hook Revolt in the Philippines. And that actually became a very important testing ground for the development of U.S. counterinsurgency operations. And one of the things that marks those U.S. counterinsurgency operations was this U.S. colonial knowledge in the more abstract sense, the kind of sense of confidence in dealing with society, produced a very sophisticated form of psychological warfare. The Philippine External Defense Forces, the Philippine Internal Security Forces were turned over. There were very close collaboration. The Joint U.S. Military Assistance Group, JUSTMAG, was established in almost a permanent advisory capacity. There were deep intelligence ties, all right?
Yeah.
But that was like, those were very similar to one of those own written chapters in the history of American global power. Is one of the things that accompanied America's post-war ascent was basically a knitting around the globe of sub-rose intelligence ties with almost every sovereign intelligence service on our side of the Iron Curtain. And those actually only began to be exposed and unraveled under the war on terror when some of them became quite controversial, right? Our ties with Swedish intelligence and Italian intelligence have both been surfaced as a result of some bungled snatch operations in Europe, in Sweden and in Italy. But you know, that's one of those things that people don't write about. That's one of sort of the crown jewels of U.S. intelligence operations, and the Philippines is a part of that. And one of the leverages we had, of course, that makes us has put us in a commanding position since the 1960s, when our raw Cold War power began to wane, was actually our edge in satellite surveillance. We can barter that for all kinds of favors. During World War, this is a period in which two things happen. The ACLU emerges as well. And this is when you begin to get this protracted debate over the proper role of the internal security apparatus. The post-war examination in the 1920s of what had happened during World War I, particularly during the Palmer Raids, the Red Scare, was enormously critical. And it was partisan, of course. I mean, you know, it was actually Republican conservatives attacking the Wilson administration. And so it was the Republicans who sort of took, in a partisan politics, a very strong civil liberties position and applied the pressure for the unraveling of this. So in the Republican ascent in the 1920s, one of the things they did was, you know, unwind this. And the most famous of all was Henry Stimson, you know, the governor, former governor general of the Philippines, the secretary of war during World War II, one of the most corporate lawyer, one of the most powerful and conservative, profoundly conservative men in American politics. In 1929, what he did was that there was a cipher branch of Van Diemen's apparatus, and Stimson said famously, this is almost a cliche in American history, gentlemen don't read each other's mail, and he wiped out the cyber unit of the U.S. military intelligence, abolished it completely. So that really set the parameters of the debate. Strict civil liberties position advocated by ACLU, by certain people who value civil liberties on both sides of the partisan divide, and this powerful apparatus with its civilian adjuncts, including the American Legion. One of the things they're doing right now is predator drones. I mean, they have a list. Okay, they have lists. Okay, of the top al-Qaeda people. Let's say on the drug side in Afghanistan, the Obama administration has ordered the liquidation of 50 top drug lords in Afghanistan. They've gone through and they've taken all the complexities of this vast sector of the Afghan economy and they've broken it down to a list of 50 top traffickers, and President Obama has authorized their death. And they are marching forward, and then they make mistakes. Very recently there was apparently the biometric data got wrong, and the U.S. forces fired on what they thought were insurgents. It turned out it was civilians and not insurgents at all. So yeah, then that's the way the system is operating. In other words, I see that as this levitation of a global system of controls, you know, from the surface of the earth, literally being sort of rooted in the ground, walking across the landscape, learning languages, having contact with people, the capacity to levitate this with a system of satellite surveillance, predator drones to literally raise it into the ether and to command the ground from the sky as the ultimate, if you will, logic of this system whose origins we're seeing at this time. Yeah. Well, I mean, Colombia, we're engaged in an active drug war, which has two components. One is satellite imagery to identify the coca fields and to engage in what's called the fumigation of the coca fields. And second, you know, we're backing the Colombian state in a war against FARC. And that involves the provision of intelligence, satellite imagery, and the rest, as well as training Colombian forces. So it's a complex two-phased operation. Yep. Well, the system 50 years ago was a very different one. And first of all, I've got to put it, comparing then and now, okay, the blanket surveillance under the old shoe leather system that we had at the time, of mail intercepts and then extra surveillance and the human intelligence, right? What it would ultimately seek to do was to identify a target. It wasn't very good at blank intelligence, okay? Because they just didn't, you know, opening envelopes, you know, it's a very, when you think about it, you know, just imagine a mail sorting room trying to open all the envelopes, okay? So what you've got to do is you identify a target, and you open a file. And that's why, for example, I could go into the military intelligence division and find my grandfather's number, because he had a number. He was a target on an ethnic profile basis. It was a family that was German American that was politically active before April 1917 in support of the Kaiser, in collecting funds in German American fundraising rallies in New York and the rest. So he was a target, because the whole my mother's family wasn't identified as pro Kaiser. So that the old system was they created targets, they opened files, and they put stuff in the files, okay? What we have now is a different system. We have a system that's operating on blanket surveillance, okay? That's looking for certain code words, okay? And then does begin to create webs. So if you go into the archives now, you'll find a file on an individual. In the future, you won't find that. What you might find, if you found anything, would be a data bank with 500 million emails in it, okay? And so it's a system of immersion of the surveillance into the society, and that's what's distinctively different. What we're heading for is, for example, okay, the countless, if you imagine the United Kingdom with those 4 million surveillance cameras operating, increasingly interlinked, all right, the trick is you can't have human eyes sitting there watching for individual people. That's not what they're working on is facial recognition technology, all right. And then ultimately it will be iris scans, I think, which they'll pick them up so that they'll be able to spot people and then track them that way. So it's an embedded surveillance rather than a targeted surveillance. That's what we're heading for.
Yeah. And on campus, actually, here UW has a CIA professor who's teaching courses on open source data mining. Right? I mean, we are recruiting in the next generation of students and then agents who are trained in these new technologies.
Yeah, that is the technology, open source data mining. Yeah. It's, you know, you just plug it into the flow of wireless and telephonic and digital communications and just. And then you build networks, but the networks are fast shifting, and so then you rebuild a network, network analysis. So it's not going to be, it's not files and targets. It's this fluid thing that apexes into a kind of array. You follow for a while, and then that fades, and you form another. But it's immersion, okay, embedding it within the flow of communications. Large question, I'm a small person. And there's a gap between the two. No, seriously. But let me just bring it down to something that why this inattention? I mean, all societies have dominant ideologies, I mean, Gramsci hegemony. And within the study of American history, the doctrine of American exceptionalism is extraordinarily strong. And there have been, over time, dissidents, Charles Beard, William Appam Williams, a number of them at my own institution, University of Wisconsin, for which we were for a time famous, the Wisconsin School of Diplomatic History, was this tiny dissident voice within this larger American historical project. And that today remains the way the system operates, you know. So that I suppose every profession has its norms, values, and higher level ideology. And the idea of American exceptionalism is deeply ingrained in the study of U.S. foreign policy. Mind you, there are more dissidents now than there were once upon a time, but still the dominant thrust of American history is in that direction, American exceptionalism. We are somehow different. That's the, you know. And the, one of the central tenets of that of exceptionalism is that we escape the curse of empire. And that this whole period that I was talking about was an aberration, very quickly corrected, and of no consequence, no lasting consequence. It left no imprint on the American state. And what I'm arguing is something fundamentally different. What I'm arguing is that, first of all, this was of consequence, and it left a fundamental and lasting imprint upon the American state. Sure. Well, the second longest running operation in the war on terror is Operation Enduring Freedom in the Philippines. I mean, we went into Afghanistan in October 2001 and went to the Philippines early 2002, and we're still there. The Philippine operation is has been a very important laboratory. I make the argument that the first target assassination that later became one of the dominant bases of U.S. success in Iraq and is now emerged as a very visible tactic and as ultimately, you know, the co-equal tactic, you know, the importance in Afghanistan first took shape in the Philippines. The neoconservatives hold up the Philippines as a prime example for the direction the global war on terror should be taking. That the combination of effective intelligence, training of local forces, and development, which was a distinctive aspect of the whole Philippine operation, which wasn't manifest with the same degree or the same success anywhere else, marks the Philippines as the model for where the operation should move in the future. So what are they doing? They're doing a whole range of things. I've met a few of these guys. And had some conversations with veterans of this operation. First of all, they're training their Filipino counterparts. They're trying to raise the performance in both intelligence and in combat capacity of their counterparts. So they're very much concerned with that. Second, they've got their own operations to run. There are targeted, the system of targeting the insurgents, which has emerged first in the Philippines.
I've heard of these planes, these drones. I'm not sure if they were Predator drones, but surveillance planes overhead as well.
So we're assisting the Philippine government under the last ambassador, Ambassador Kenny. If you may remember, she had that rewards for justice system, right? And she very publicly stood there with the head of the AFP, and they held up a giant placard in Jolo, and she crossed them off as they had been killed and handed out bonus rewards, okay? But that operation, I'm sure you've seen, so the intelligence support for, there may be Filipino forces that go in and do the hits, but it's the intelligence, a lot of the cell phone intercepts that are going to target the people and actually fix their location, all of that is going to be an American operation. So they're providing that critical operational intelligence for that program. And then they're also concerned about the transnational linkages with Indonesia and Thailand and beyond, which is a constant concern. And they're probably part of an intelligence network that ranges all the way to Somalia, okay? So that there's that constant chatter right across the operational zone. Spanning the whole of basically the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. As an uninformed observer, that's what I think the parameters of the operation are. But it's part of this multifaceted operation that ranges from Somalia all the way to the Philippines, and it's all interlinked. Yeah, they would love to do it, I'm sure, but the point is that they've been rendered technologically redundant. They're out on the street along with all the rest of us, okay? don't need them anymore. The moment came in 2002. President Bush announced very dramatically in a speech that he was going to create something called TIPS, and that there were going to be FedEx and UPS and mailmen and meter readers and gas readers, and anybody moving across public space were going to be asked to report. And there was a huge backlash against this, and he had to cancel it. And then inside the Pentagon, Admiral John Poindexter of Iran-Contra fame created something called the Total Information Awareness Program, created a all-seeing eye, mysterious kind of New Age Sphinx-like, sort of a pyramid-like logo with an eye, and it looked like the back of a dollar bill. It was going to do deep data mining. Well, there was created an uproar, and he was fired out. Okay, what happened then was that in the aftermath of this, what Bush realized that even at the peak of patriotism and fear, that after this century-long experience of going through the Red Scare, the McCarthyite period, the Vietnam era, the breaking up these operations, bringing in the reforms like the FISA Act that we did, all of that, that American political culture had changed. And even at this moment of maximum mobilization and fear, that wasn't going to work anymore. Okay, we couldn't go back. And so what happened then was that's when President Bush pulled, we don't actually have the date, but I expect that it's about the same time that he gave orders, an executive order, to the NSA to begin their illegal surveillance and phone tapping that we know was exposed by the New York Times in 2005. It's believed to have started in early 2002. So I think Bush, in fact, suffered this major political defeat on the TIPS program, ending this old model, okay, that was sort of in the Republican collective consciousness somehow from the old days. That broken, he shifted then to this purely electronic form. And that's where it's all migrated to. And indeed, it turned out that, in the cut and thrust of politics, that's where he should have moved to if you want to build a modern day surveillance state. So I think that I see as a sort of a historical turning point, when the old paradigm that I've been talking about is rendered the proper topic of historians because it's long past and no longer relevant, okay? And a new paradigm takes form. The one thing that I didn't emphasize enough in this talk was the moment in the 1970s, okay, when you had this deeply rooted structure, okay, with this very, at that point, very wide CIA, U.S. Army intelligence, and FBI, and then their civilian adjuncts in this very elaborate penetration of U.S. society, okay? And in the midst of the Cold War, in the partisan divide of the Vietnam War, that this was slowly undone, okay? That FBI was forced to abolish COINTELPRO. And you can go into the FBI website and right now read the Bureau's own history of itself. And it talks about COINTELPRO as having been an illegal operation, which was a mistake by the Bureau, and they repudiate it, okay? The CIA doesn't have such a history, but they were forced to abolish Operation Chaos, and they were forced to redraw that bright line that they cannot operate inside the United States. And then we put the FISA courts in, which, although it may be a kind of legal fig leaf, because I don't know if they've ever denied the surveillance apparatus a warrant, but it requires the court's imprimatur, all right? And that really undid this apparatus. I mean, it got undone once politically in the 1920s. It recovered through the process I've described. It built up to this peak in the 1970s, was pulled back again. And right now, there is, I think, as we're moving away from the war on terror, there is now a serious debate and discussion just beginning, all right, that's going to actually begin to try and say, okay, if this is what we have to do in order to conduct modern counterintelligence, how do we then, within this apparatus, begin to impose controls? And there's actually, there is some awareness of this, and there is a very fragile and faint movement building to actually regulate this and impose some boundaries, okay? And it's only taken shape. Unfortunately, the expose came on the eve of the 2008 elections, and the Democrats decided, as they did in 2004, on the torture issue. Okay, they were just going to let that one go. Al Gore actually did it to focus groups. Focus groups didn't like Abu Ghraib, didn't want to talk about it at all. Al Gore didn't talk about torture during his campaign. Kerry didn't talk about it. Kerry didn't talk about it. He actually focus grouped it. All right. Well, in 2008, the Democrats, you know, realizing that they had a chance to get power, they went along with the congressional legitimation of Bush's illegal wiretapping through NSA. They actually legalized it, and they expanded upon his authority. They legalized his illegal actions. And they immunized the regional telecommunications companies that had been participating from civil suit. Okay, and they did that purely because in the eve of an election, which they thought they would win, they didn't want to be weak on national security. Well, now it's possible to revisit that. Unfortunately, as often happens with civil liberties, it's got a fragile kind of constituency. But it's nonetheless, it's something that is part of the political process now. There is debate and discussion. So as this is created by human agency, it can be undone by human agency. But nonetheless, there is a long-term bureaucratic trajectory that's pushing this all forward. And I would argue that sort of at the lowest level, it's this information technology. It's this ongoing American and global information revolution that creates capacity. And once you have capacity, bureaucracy will use capacity unless restrained. And it's that dynamic between, if you will, the mechanistic grinding of technological progress and the episodic imposition of human agency that is the if you will, the shape of the narrative that we're describing. The thrust is going to come with iris scans. Because, you know, if you're ever so blessed and your little kid comes home from the hospital, you remember this? Get a little piece of paper and you got that little cute footprint so that, you know, they won't lose the babies. Well, actually what they're talking about now is that we should do an iris scan.
It's
non-invasive, and also, you know, it's unerring, all right? And it never changes throughout your life. So once you scan a baby, you know, to get a birth certificate, you have the iris scan for all times, all right? And it now takes 15 seconds, but that time for the match, the algorithmic match, well, I think what United Arab Emirates uses it, and they do 12 billion iris matches a day as their immigration control, 12 billion a day. So there is that when I say that technological thrust is biometrics is pushing us forward, and now what we're seeing things, for example, the statements coming out of U.S. military that are involved in cyber warfare, which is the new frontier, and you may have read that, you know, for the first time, that the cyberspace command, that an intelligence service has actually been created as an operational command now. And so it's gotten enormous priority and prestige. And so this arm, and the cyber warriors are all saying there is no sovereignty in cyberspace. There's no border or boundary that can separate the idea of civil liberties at home and aggressive operations abroad. And so that then creates a problem, and civil libertarians haven't begun to deal with that problem of how do you, in a globalized world of information, where the security is in fact seamless and worldwide, how do you then protect citizens' rights within the boundaries of a sovereign state? In a world in which this global web of communications and movement transcends and defies and almost mocks those very boundaries and the idea of citizenship and protection of citizens' rights within those boundaries. I mean, these are really fundamental issues that very few people are beginning to talk about. And certainly it's not percolated beyond, I'm sure there's a couple law review articles out there I haven't read, or somebody in information technology that's written something really obscure that I haven't seen, but it's certainly not percolated into common discourse. Yep. How could I put it? I shoot from the hip, completely an expert, subject to correction, okay? I could be completely wrong, but, okay, the frame, whether it be colony or nation state, may change. But ultimately, what you're talking about is information and power and control. And it may go global beyond a single colony, but that's still there. And the mechanism for its projection may require more bases, smaller ones, or fewer. But the control will need to be there, right? So the, for the system to function. Because it's still a system that, again, very broadly, still resides, you know, global rhetoric of equity and human rights residing with gross inequality in the distribution of rewards. What is it? A third of humanity is illiterate? I mean, the war over water yet to come. A planet that's got, you know, real inequality of access to resources. Okay, well, whether or not we are slowly moving towards equitable distribution, but there are those that will challenge the order in the here and now rather than waiting for the system to resolve the kinks in the trajectory of centuries. And that will be a challenge to this order. And when any order is challenged, that order meets the challenge with the means at its command. If it lacks the means, it creates the means. And that's the dynamic we've talked about here. A system is challenged. U.S. military control and conquest of the Philippines is challenged. It then reaches into its technological kit bag and comes up with a deft application of the technology, stretching that technology, at least in the application, to limits and beyond. Okay? And then the system, okay, so then you get nation states, independence, and then another iteration of that same process. Challenge, technological response, change in the systems. I think we should